This is the Final Round Podcast, coming to you live from the FingerLakes1.com studios in downtown Seneca Falls, New York. And now your host, Chris Marquardt.
Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to this edition of the Final Round Drag Racing Podcast. We've got the folks from the RVA Racing List down in Richmond, Virginia, joining us for episode number 36. We're going to be catching up with Kevin Orr at the bottom half of the hour to talk a little bit more about some of the racing that he's got planned with the TNT series and his Corvette. But Ed Brewster, our buddy, we talked about him a little bit when we were getting ready for Finger Lakes Speed World, and he was up here with the RC Derbies. He works very closely with a group called Performance Dynamics down there near JMW HQ, and turned us on to the group with the RVA List, which races primarily at Richmond International, right near the airport down in Virginia. It's the track that, if you're thinking of that track, that's the one that they race at. Their first race of the season is coming up on Saturday. We're going to be talking with those guys about that, and also we're going to be looking a little bit ahead to their schedule. They race once a month through the course of the season. But before that, Jason Oldfield joining us here. Been a tumultuous Thursday.
It's been interesting to say the least, but hey, we made it. We're here.
To say the least.
Yeah, looking forward to talking to these guys. I find this type of racing really interesting. Kind of the heads up. First one of the finish line, who's the baddest of the bad style racing, I really find interesting. And one of these days, I'll, I guess, take my skirt off and maybe go try and race one of these types of races myself.
Right. The RVA List is split into quarter mile and eighth mile.
Right.
The quarter mile is it's your typical heads-up race. The eighth mile, they don't show you the times. And it's direct to green, and both of the classes are going off the line on street tires.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a lot. While it's still a top 10 list, like what you're probably accustomed to seeing on something like Street Outlaws, it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
And they're trying to do things to keep it affordable, which anybody who's trying to keep drag racing affordable, you got to applaud the effort, right?
It's not the easiest thing in the world to do, for sure, and I will say that in general what you see is that it starts out affordable, different classes, series like this. There's always one guy that ends up wrecking it for everybody, but we'll see. Hopefully they've been able to essentially adjust their rules appropriately, basically, to keep it in line. I did see that one of the rules was DOT tires, so... Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one thing that can definitely help a lot, because you're going to build a car with 4,000 horsepower. You're going to have a hard time potentially getting it down the track with DOT tires. I guess I'm curious to find out what that means, though.
Well, it seems like this is a perfect time to welcome Brandon Terry, who owns Get Fast One, which is a popular parts distributorship and fabrication shop on top of overseeing RVA List at Richmond. Jason, man, how are you?
Hey, how you doing tonight, guys?
We're doing just fine. You got a sharp looking C10 pickup truck that you own.
Thank you. I don't know about sharp looking. It's a little rough, but I get the job done.
It looks perfect. So we were just talking a little bit about what RVA is and where things are headed in terms of the rules and what you guys do and how it compares to other stuff that people might be equally familiar with. And the big thing that jumped off the page right off the top was the DOT tires. So I guess first off, what does the DOT tire mean, and what does that mean in terms of track preparation and actually getting the tires to hook up so they can get down the track?
Okay, so and I got Jason on here now too. So
perfect.
Jason's here. And Jason Blankenship runs our Super Street List, which is the quarter mile list, and I run the ultimate street list, which is the eighth mile list. Both classes are centered around street cars, so we do require the DOT tires on the cars, meaning that they have to have a DOT certification where they're street legal to drive. Now, I will say, you slicks are a little more forgiving on a marginal track, so if you've got a lot of power and suspension not quite there, the track's not quite prepped as good, you can get down faster on a slick than you can a drag radial. But again, we allow DOT tires. We do allow bias ply DOT tires, which are close to a slick but not quite a slick.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just basically trying to keep these cars street legal, be a car that you can see drive down the street every day. And, a lot of these cars you do see at the cruise ends and the drives and I know Jason's class, his Super Street class, they actually meet at our shop. They take about a 15-mile drive to the track every race before they race. So that being said, and in our class as well, there's a street drive challenge to where if you don't think a competitor has a street car, you can challenge it to a street drive, and you'll have to go on a street drive before they race. So we do require the DOT tires, because if any of them get pulled over and they're on slick, then they're going to get a ticket. You know, so that's one reason we require the DOT tires.
What else are you doing in terms of the rules to keep them more show and shine, cruising type cars, and not get into that realm of being, you know, more professional or at least drag racing focused entries?
Right. And, you know, so what we do is we don't allow fiberglass front ends. We don't allow fiberglass doors. You cannot have Lexan windows. You cannot have fender exit exhaust or exhaust that comes out through the hood. You know, a lot of the turbo guys, and a big thing now, even with nitrous guys, they want to have the exhaust come out the fenders, which you wouldn't see a car at a dealership with exhaust coming out the fenders. So we limit that. We have no forward-facing hood scoops. We make you have front seats, carpet, dash pad. Jason's class, the Super Street class, goes even further than that. They have like every single panel in the car that came factory. You know,
really?
It has little sail panels that are padded. It's got the headliner. It's got to have all that stuff too. That way we can
full street safety equipment is what we require. Everything from wipers to full safety glass, that type of thing.
So, I mean, that it just seems. It's interesting to me. You know, how much power are we talking in these cars? Because you're talking about guys with turbos that want to run the exhaust through the fenders, but they can't. So are we talking about major power? I mean, some of the times we were kicking around before the show started, it seems like these guys are making some pretty serious passes.
Like I said, this is Jason's class, but the guy just got on the list. He's number 10. Last year he put up a time at the World Cup Finals, I believe it was like an 8.95 in the quarter, and then
that was 8.95. I don't remember his mile an hour. I think 155-ish maybe.
Right.
They did it at 3,800 pounds as well.
Jason, you're nodding your head over there.
Yeah, that's
Jason runs on the list as well. He's currently number 2 on the Super Street list, and his car last year went at what, a 921 at 127,
927, I think 146, and I did it at 3,500 pounds.
Yeah, so that's some pretty good power, obviously. Those kind of ETs with that kind of weight behind it.
Right.
Now,
and,
is that.
My as far as Ultimate Street goes, we don't show times. Because a lot of the guys who run our class, like the Grudge Race, and they run some races to where you're not allowed to have shown your times before you race, so we don't put them up. But, I mean, I can give you an idea. Like, my truck, on motor, it makes 750 horsepower, and we spray 42 jets in the fogger, which is a 500 hit.
Yep.
So, you know, you add the 750 with the 500, and you kind of see what we're working with.
That's crazy.
Now, is that running on now in your class? Is that Super Street's the class that Jason runs, right?
Right.
Yes.
And then it's Ultimate Street. Is that what the other class is?
Correct. That's the class I run.
Okay. Now, in Ultimate Street, do you have to do the cruise to the track as well?
In Ultimate Street, you do not. You can trailer your cars to the track. However, if you go to race somebody and they think, you know, you're not a street car, they can put up $100, they can challenge you to a street drive. Where the street drive is, off top of my head, I think it's 15 miles. 15 miles street drive. They have to, both cars, so if I challenge you to the street drive, I have to do the street drive as well.
Sure.
Both cars go, run the 15 miles, come back, go right to the stage lanes, and have to immediately race.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Right. So it keeps the guy from going out and putting a 900 cubic inch, you know, 16-to-1 motor with a 900 lift cam in it that runs on straight alcohol. Full of concrete. From just jumping in there and, you know, switching a motor out between races. And, you know, so we can, you know, we know what these guys run. You can hear the difference in the motor stuff. And if you think the guy's not a street car, you can challenge it to a street drive. And if he completes it and you challenge him, he gets $100 you put up.
Yeah. Now, I mean, that said, I mean, your truck, I mean, making 750 horse plus the shot of nitrous. Now, okay, I realize that the shot of nitrous, you're not going to use that until you get on the track. But is that 750 horse, is that with pump gas or is that racing fuel or?
No, that's we run racing fuel, man. Now, I could cut my time and way back and run pump gas, but we don't. I just run the racing fuel in it.
I still think it's pretty neat the way that it's set up, because I mean it's mirroring all the popular listing stuff, but
oh, yeah.
They're doing it in such a reasonable way. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's part of the problem with the way the show Street Outlaws really got out of hand, and I guess to a certain extent, I don't know whether it was just for TV, if the TV producers, Discovery, said, hey, we want to reel this in, or if it really was the, Big Chief and the list that did it. But, you know, it got to the point where those guys were literally just racing pro mods on the street. It's like, all right, yeah, right, I realize you're racing right. on an unprepped surface, but that's not exactly a street car.
Right, and then if you watch, the fans really don't respond to that. The fans want to see a car they can relate to.
That's right.
Anybody can take a 2,000-pound Pro Mod and put a motor in it and go fast.
That's right.
That's easy to do. But when you got cars like Jason's 3,500 pounds, the number 10 guy's 3,800 pounds, my truck weighs 4,000 pounds on the scale. when you see cars like that are going fast with, full interior, the only lightweight components we allow are bumpers, hoods, and trunk lids. They all got OEM glass, the roll-up windows in them. When you see a car leave the line, like one of our competitors is John Dunn. He's got a Dodge Dart with a Hemi in it, and he leaves the line dragging the bumper half the time. There's some videos on our YouTube channel of him. And that's a bad ride, man. And we've been to several car shows around town, and he comes cruising right up in there with it. And then he goes to the track on the weekend and stands it up on the back bumper.
Yeah, that's very cool. Now, we did, before the show, we went to the website, and I think we potentially saw some pictures of his car. Is that an original Hemi car?
It's not an original Hemi car. There's a good story on that car. If y'all look up his preseason interview from last year, he talks about the car, and it actually, his dad owned a repair shop, and his dad acquired the car, and it sat outside for I think like 15 years, and that's how it got all rusty and dirty.
Okay.
And beat up, and he just took the car and basically put a cage in it, put a motor in it, and put a rear end in it, and went racing with it, and just left it alone as far as the body goes.
Yeah, we were making notes of the patina on the car, and we both thought that was pretty cool, actually, the fact that it still looked like this. Chris is showing a picture of the front end right now, and you can see where, the rust and, looks like the fender panel's been pounded out a little bit to try and get it straight again. But, yeah, that's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. One of the races, he put it on the bumper, and then the car, when he hit the bumper, it kind of went to the right, and when he let it down, it hit the guardrail, and then he kept going. And when he came back, everybody was looking for the scratches on the car, and they couldn't find them because the car's so beat up anyway. So, takes patina to the max.
But that's some of the charm of what this class is. Let's take a quick look here. This is the rundown of the lists. Now, we talked about cars that we could relate to.
Right.
Dial it back to the conversation that we had a couple weeks ago when we were at Finger Lakes Speed World, and we talked about the Mustangs and the different bodies that were over top of those frames. Number one, Jimmy B in the Super Street, 1979 LS-powered Ford Fairmont.
Yeah.
There it is right there.
There it is right there, yeah.
Nitrous outlets.
That's a bad ride. That's a sweet ride.
Running on through Jason Blankenship, who's on the line with us right now, Patrick Depew, Louis Dimitrizin, or something close to that, Matt.
Louis Dimitrizin?
Yeah. What's he got?
The red Mustang, that is a Coyote-powered car. It was actually a nitrous plate on it last year. Mm-hmm. He has gone single turbo for this year.
Wow. Huh. That's kind of cool.
Yes, he was. I think he had took into the nines at the end of last year. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised to see that car make a jump straight from high nines to bottom nines, if not into the eights, pretty easily.
Matt Sangpeel, Joey Buck, Brian Lumpy, Keith Keith Breslin, Zach Reed, and Adam Dean rounding out the top 10 on the current Super Street list. And then on top of that, we've got Brandon Tuck, who's leading the list for the Ultimate Street. He's got a Chevy Big Block powered Ford Mustang. It's a Tuck-built racing engine with an induction solutions nitrous system on it. Rich Tillman is next, Mike Ratliff, John Dunn, Don Huckster, Brandon Terry, Gene Motley, Pete Decker, Chuck Otters, and Charles Forrest rounding up the top 10 on the Ultimate Street list. When you're figuring in who's ranking where, is it only on head-to-head? Is there a way to jump up the list based on your top speed when you guys have meets? Are you guys racing head-to-head? How's all that play out for a particular day and moving up and down the list itself?
Okay. So what we do is if you want a chance to get on the list, we have a shootout. As many people as they want can sign up for the shootout. So most shootouts we have between 12 and 20 cars in the shootout per class usually. So what happens is everybody goes on Facebook, they put the picture of their car and says, we want a chance to get on the list. So when they show up at the track, we basically draw cards. Whoever draws each other runs. We get down to the final person who wins the shootout. They get to challenge the number 10 car on the list.
Okay.
If they beat the number 10 car on the list, they are now on the list.
Okay.
Once you get on the list, you can call out the car above you.
Okay.
So if you beat that car, you get to call the next guy. You beat that car, you get to call the next guy out. We typically have 3 to 4 rounds of racing per night. Mm-hmm. So you can potentially move up, 3 to 4 positions per night. If you get beat, basically the guy behind you gets a chance to call you out. So as long as you win your races, you can move up 3 spots. But if you don't win your races, of course, you get a call out from the guy behind you, and you might actually end up dropping.
So you have to win the shootout, and then after that, you can do up to 3 rounds of racing after that, just on call outs. So conceivably, you're winning up to 7 rounds of racing.
You don't necessarily move 3 spots the same night. Generally, just from time constraints, once you win the shootout, your last race of the night will be to race the number 10 guy.
Got it.
If you beat the 10 guy, you're now on the list. If you lose, you don't make it on the list. You just won the shootout for the night, no more or less.
Got it.
Right, and then when you come back for the next race, you'll have your chance to call out the number 9 guy and so on.
Now, you said in a normal night when you're having a shootout, you'll have 10 to 12 cars just in the shootout?
Normally we have between 12 and 20 cars sign up. Usually we'll have 12 to 16 cars that show up for the shootout. We'll have 20 sign up, and then you know how these cars are.
Yeah.
They're finicky. You go to put them, you go to take them to track, and something breaks, something happens, and you get there and make a test run, you break something. But most typical nights we have 12 to 16, 18 cars in the actual shootout to try to get on the list.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. And then the rest of the night we
have at least 50 cars running between the 10 on each list and the 2 shootouts to try to get on the list. We typically bring about 50 cars to the track.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't believe there's that many. It's unbelievable. Now, while you're doing the shootout, do you have list racing going on at the same time that the shootout's going on? Is that the way you do it?
You want to answer that, Jason?
Yeah, I'll answer it. So pretty much every night when we get out there, we'll get together and have a big group meeting. We draw cards for lanes, and we also draw cards in order to line up the shootout guys to draw randomly unless they want to make a call out. But we try to mirror everything. So we'll run the first round of Super Street Shootout, then we'll run the first round of Ultimate Street Shootout, then that gets followed by the first round of List Racing Shootout, followed by the first round of Blitz Racing of Ultimate Street. So you'll see basically two classes, but all in one round. You'll see both class shootouts as well as both class Blitz Racing, and we try to get off about 4 rounds per night.
Yeah. That's now I was, Chris is showing some pictures of some of the competitors' cars, and I guess one question I had is, with regards to like suspensions and things of that nature, is there any restrictions as far as what you can do from that standpoint? I mean, if it's, let's call it still a stock body, but I mean, could you put a cage and a four link and all the rest of it as long as it's still a stock body?
Right. So each class has its own set of rules as far as suspension goes. In Ultimate Street, you can have like bolt-in front ends. So basically, if you want to put an aftermarket K-member, like a tubular K-member,
yep,
you know, it can bolt in. You just can't weld it in. You can have four links, ladder bars. Now, if you move your frame rails, so if you narrow your frame rails, move them in any, it's considered a back half car.
Yep.
And then you have a weight penalty for that, which I believe it's 300 pounds.
Okay. Right. Yeah, 300 pounds. Yep.
So basically, a small block with a small tire has to weigh 2,800 pounds. If you have a small block with a big tire, you have to weigh 3,100 pounds.
Okay.
If you have a big block, you got to weigh 3,000 pounds. But if you have a big block that's tubbed up, you have to weigh 3,300 pounds.
And that's an Ultimate
we
Street.
We haven't had any issue with weight because, like I said, these are all street cars. They got to have the factory glass, seats, carpet,
right,
dash. Most guys, yeah, are way over the weight limit.
I mean, it's almost hard to get down that low.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I mean, you know, just in my car as a comparison. So, I mean, stock body. Now I have Lexan in the windows, but you know, all the interior.
We're talking the Corvette, right?
We're talking the Corvette, right? So with me in it, Corvette, small block, back half car. I'm 2,600 pounds with me in it. So per the rules, I thought I heard that I'd have to be at 3,100 pounds with a small block back half.
Yeah.
I'd have a hard time adding 500 pounds of ballast. So yeah, now you got to say, all right, I have to put the stock glass back in. I'd have to do that right off the bat. But yeah, right, now at this point, I'm looking for places that I can add weight. So yeah, I might as well throw all the full interior back in it and do all the rest of those things, because 500 pounds is a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And we did that, you know, specifically to keep the race cars out.
Right.
Because, you know, if you, like you said, you've got to meet that weight anyway. You might as well have your seats in it, your carpet, your dash,
that's
your
right,
little panels, yeah, you know, your glass. And that's why we did that, just to basically keep pro mods from coming in or guys with race cars and going, oh, well, let me just put a DOT tire in here and come try to wreck this class.
Right.
You know, and again, we do a lot of things with these cars, too. We don't just race them. We go to cruise-ins. We go to car meets. We do different things like that. So these cars do get driven on the street, and they do go to shows. I just took my truck to the Speed Trend Society meet at Cabela's in Short Pump. We go as a group a lot of times to different races. Like we went to Dominion Raceway for a no prep event they had. And I believe like 7 or 8 list cars came to that.
Okay.
Then we went to Maryland for Street Racing Made Safe had an event up there, and they did a little cash days up there. And I think 15 cars went with us up there. So we do go to different things. So we like these cars to meet the requirements for pretty much anywhere we go. So that's why we, you know, require all the things that we require. So when we go different places, there's no, well, you can't run here because you don't have that or you don't have this.
Right, right. Now, you had mentioned that you went to a no-prep race. So your typical races at Richmond are, they're a prep track, right?
Richmond is a prep track.
I think the best way to put it is we end up with typically what we would consider like a Friday night prep.
Okay.
Because generally we run with an open test and two.
Sure.
So we do have cars out there on true hard tire DOTs. So we're fighting against that at the same time. So it's not like every car that goes down is batting and laying rubber and, you know, being able to be dragged and continuously prep.
Yeah, we'll run around a race and then they'll run just test and tune for whoever. And you could have a diesel truck go out there and all, you know, and with big grippy mud tires, and he'll go out there and just rip up the rubber that was laid
right
out. So we go back out there, you'll have bald spots in the track. You'll,
yeah,
you know, it's not like you're going to an event where it's radial prepped. I mean, so that's part of the challenge here. And that's why we like running at Richmond and doing it on days like that, because you can have a car that's set on kill, you know, say at an event like in Maryland, you know, at the World Cup Finals, where anything will go down, you know.
Right.
And you come to Richmond and you've got to play with the computer, you got to play with the tune, you've got to ramp your power in, and it adds to it to make it more of the racer and not necessarily the car.
Yeah, I will say
that probably our hardest race months is probably July and August. The sun sets to your back as you would be racing down the track, and when we first get out there, the track will just be, I mean, we raced last time, I think the heat index was over 100 this past summer.
Right.
Yep. The track is so greasy, you can't put any power down for generally the first round or even the first couple rounds, but as soon as the sun goes behind the trees, the track just goes tight immediately, and you can almost throw everything at it.
Right, right.
So it's ever changing throughout the night when we get out on those hot nights like that.
Yeah, and I will say that I really appreciate that style of racing. You know, it's not what I do. I mean, I'm a super gas racer, so I'm a throttle stop racer. But, you know, it's funny because the way that those classes have evolved, you basically have guys making more and more power and putting more and more time in their throttle stops. And now what these guys expect is everyone expects every race to be a national event prep track because they want to be able to get their, you know, 1,200 or 1,300 horsepower dragster or, you know, light super gas car down the track. And it's like, look, I mean, that should be part of the whole game, right? It's like, you want to build a 1300 horsepower motor? Well, congratulations, good on you, but it's going to be up to you to get that down the track. Now it shouldn't be the track's responsibility to make a surface specifically for you so you can get it down the track. But that's not the way guys generally see it. Generally what you hear is the track is junk and this, that, and the other thing. And that's one thing I like, I have to say, about the Street Outlaw guys. I mean, they'll say, okay, yeah, it's not a very good road, it's one of the worst roads that we've raced on, but overall no one's complaining about it. It's everyone's racing on the same street, everyone's running on the same surface, and it's whoever can tune their car the best to get down that patch of road or that drag strip ends up being the winner that night. And I really appreciate that.
Right. And I mean, for an example, Charles Forrest, he's our number 10 guy. He just got on the list. It took him 6 shootouts to get on the list, and he's by far has more horsepower, more motor than anybody on the list, but it took him 6 tries to get on because of track conditions.
Yeah.
And because, you know, you got to run 5 rounds in the shootout to win it most nights, then you still got to run the number 10 guy, which Charles has made it there before to run the number 10 guy and gotten beat, just because you've already ran 5 rounds, the sun's down, the track's getting cold, he's got all this horsepower, and it's just hard to hide it, you know what I mean? It's hard to manage it.
Right.
So you live and die by your tune-up, really.
Yeah.
So we get guys come on there all the time, and, man, I got this car, it makes 2,600 horsepower, I'm going to run over top of y'all. They'll come out, and they don't make it past first round.
He had to win 34 rounds of racing in order to get on the list.
34.
Well, he had to make 34 passes. He had to win 30 rounds.
Oh, because he had to win the shootout multiple times.
Yeah, in order to get the shot at number 10. So just counting his appearances against number 10.
Right.
He had to make 35 passes and win 31 of them. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, is crazy.
And he's broke up a lot of stuff trying. He's put his car on the bumper, you know, because like I said, he'll come out one time and it'll spin. The next time it'll put on the bumper. And he put on the bumper so hard when he came down, it broke the motor mounts off the dart block when it hit. So, you know, like I said, it's ever-changing conditions, and you have to really change your car per round. You know, you have to see the track, feel it out, walk it, see what other people are doing. And I know, like me and Jason, we'll both make changes sometimes in the staging lanes right before we race.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, where did the idea for this series come about? I mean, how long has it been? How long have you had the series active?
We're going into our 3rd year with it. The first year, Johnny Davis, he runs Richmond Dragway. A couple tracks around had tossed around the idea, and one had started. I believe Cecil County had started a list. So Johnny thought it'd be cool to have it as track. So. He started the list, and like most business owners, you know, we get a lot on our plate, and he started the list, and he was running the track, and the list, you know, we were kind of running it amongst ourselves, you know, for the first year. We had a ball, had a good time, went fairly smooth, but it started to catch on, and more people started to come out, and we at Performance Dynamics saw an opportunity to kind of take the lead on it, and relieved Johnny from trying to run the track and the race, and we took over running the series, and started doing the promotions for it, started doing videos for it, and then last year, the last 2 races of last year, we added the second class that Jason actually took his car off of Ultimate Street and moved it over to Super Street and started running that class, So the end of last year is when we added the second class. So this year will be our first full year with the quarter mile class.
Oh, okay.
How was the quarter mile class received? I mean, quarter mile's been a hot topic lately as more tracks move to shorter distances and tracks close, and you know, people say they want to run quarter, people say they want to run eighth, and the numbers don't always align with what you're told. How did the quarter mile piece come about?
So, I mean, we kind of started out with all the steam arguments you see all over any of the other forums. We had some turbo guys saying, you know, the nitrous guys had the advantage in the eighth, which, I mean, you can make both go fast in the eighth, but more from a street aspect, I felt like, and listened to, I felt like there was a group of racers that were missing out that could enjoy the list out racing, and most of those types of cars can go a quarter mile. True, like, street driven could be driven to work on a daily basis if you had to.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, let's stretch them out the back door. I think we have, what, 3 or 2 quarter-mile tracks in Virginia. Luckily, we have one right in our backyard. So We figured we'd take advantage of that, push them out the back door, and turn the clocks on with it at the same time. One of the biggest things we constantly have is the fans want to know how fast the cars are going. So most of the cars running quarter-mile class typically were showing times anyway for the most part.
Right.
So we figured that would be a good way to I guess kind of show how fast these cars were going and what they were capable of.
And the logic behind not showing the time is to keep it more, I don't know, I guess to keep it more honest. So if people want to hide their horsepower, they have that ability. Or if they want to lay it all out there, they can show how bad their pass is.
Yeah, so that's kind of a hot topic in itself, you know, no time racing versus time racing. I'm a proponent for showing time. I'd rather show time. You know, I put a lot of work in my truck, and, you know, I'd like to show people how fast it goes. However, some of the people who run the class, you know, like I said, they run other races where they don't allow them to show times, and they can't show time within a whole year. If they show times within a whole year, then they can't run the race. The reason for that is a lot of guys do grudge racing and betting. So they feel like if I go out there and lay down a pass, somebody's going to throw a number out there. Say I run an 8-second quarter-mile pass. Well, then I run next to another guy and I beat him by a fender. Well, you can assume that guy runs a low eight, you know, or a mid eight, because you can judge him off my time. So that's why people don't want to show times, so they can grudge race and bet money and basically kind of sneak up on people in a way. I, like I said, I'm a proponent of showing time. We've had this discussion a couple times with our Ultimate Street guys. It always ends in they don't want to show time. So as a group, you know, we take everybody's opinion, and we have just kept the clocks off in our Ultimate Street class.
Huh.
Yeah, and I honestly, I don't know what to think. I get why the guys don't want to show ETs. Being, I guess, you know, an old school drag racer, I mean, from my standpoint, you know, it's like I really want to see ETs up on the boards, and I feel like at least for me, it takes away from the show not having the ETs, but I don't know if it does for the normal fan. I don't know if it really matters for them to be able to see the ETs. For me, yeah, it makes a difference to me. But and again, I get why the guys don't want to show it. I just don't. I guess I'm on the fence with regards to whether or not if I was competing there, I'd want my time
fans,
shown.
Our fans,
I agree 100% on that. I mean, like I said, we've had that talk, because, you know, the number one question we get from fans, like Jason said earlier, was how fast are these cars? I mean, they know they're fast, but they want to know how fast they are.
Right.
And we can't really say, because we're not, you know, and it does make it tough. It's a tough subject. But like I said, just the majority of the racers don't want to show the time, so we've just stuck with it. Now, we don't make people not show times in other races. So if they want to take their car and they want to run a different race that shows time, they're allowed to.
Yeah.
We're not strict about it. So they can go to other places and show times if they like. And I know a couple of our racers have. And people have been really surprised at how fast they were. You know, because it's hard to judge when you're at a track, you know, and you're looking at a car go by, you don't realize how quick or slow they are. But when they have gone to some of these other events and show times, you know, it's really shocked people.
Is it possible?
I'll chime in on a few things if y'all don't mind. The other good thing I think has worked for both classes is that the one, like Ultimate Street, doesn't show a time. So people are kind of taking a guess at how fast they think the cars are. So that brings the big shootout count every time because they think they got enough to take those cars based on what they see, not right. based on the evidence of the time clock lighting up, where the other side of that is in Super Street, they're seeing how fast we are. So they think on the flip side, well, I know my car's faster than that. I'm going to come out there, and I know I can get on the list. Well, then the same thing still happens in both classes. They come out, and like we talked about earlier, they end up finding out you really got to race the track on a Friday night out there. Obviously, if you bring a fast enough car, you can come out and get on the list, but you still got to race throughout the night. But either way, both ways, like Brandon was talking about, the grudge racing, the great thing with the list racing is when you make it to somebody and it's somebody you want to race, they got to race you. You can't dodge a race. So it doesn't matter what happens when you guys meet up, you're going to race each other. That's been great. And we've seen a huge following even with people's kids and bringing their kids out because they can understand heads-up racing.
Sure.
The light turns green and the wind light comes on. So it's very easy for a fan to understand who wins the race versus letting kind of pick a kid out and watch something like bracket race.
Right.
Is there a difference from a fan point of view? Maybe from a diehard fan point of view, there might be a difference. But from a casual fan point of view, the way you just described with you know somebody bringing their kid up to the track, a race that's decided by an eyelash when both of the cars are going through the lights in 9 seconds versus a race that's decided by an eyelash when both of the cars are going through the lights at 14 and a half seconds? Is there a difference there?
Typically, people want to see a fast car. You know, they when they come out, you know, they want to see a car. You know, and it's, the faster your car is, the more chance of it breaking loose, wheeling.
Sure.
You know, just different things happen. There's just more excitement the faster the cars go. So typically, from a fan aspect, they want to see a fast car. If they're paying to watch a race, you know, they want to see a quick car. They want to see a car put it on the bumper. They want to see some action, you know, and you don't typically get that with the slower cars. I mean, they're fun. I mean, we all started somewhere. I mean, first time I went to the track, I think I ran at 18 in the quarter. So we all start somewhere, but the faster cars are typically a better show. So that seems to be what the fans want to see.
Is it possible then to amend the finish lights so that it's only showing mile per hour? Because if somebody's way out on somebody else and they lift off and they roll through, they're slowing down. So they're still guarding their cards a little bit. I mean, is it possible to just show mile an hour and not show ET?
I'm shaking my head no. I'm shaking my head no, because obviously from the mile an hour, you know, if I'm way in front of somebody and I let off and I, you know, cruise through at 80 miles an hour, obviously everybody knows that, he lifted at three-quarter track, right?
Yeah, and if you have a good close heads up race and they show their mile an hour and you know they weren't letting off, there's a lot of good calculators out there on the internet to figure out who runs what. So, you know, that thought has crossed their mind with a mile per hour, but in the end, you know, you can pretty much figure out what they run if you know their mile an hour.
Right.
We found one a couple shows ago.
Yeah, that's right.
we use it on the air.
Yeah, for sure. So your guys' first race is coming up here. Is it this weekend?
This Saturday at Richmond Dragway. The gates open at 10 o'clock. The track goes hot at 11, so guys will be making some test runs between 11 and 12:30. Our first driver's meeting is at 12:10, and then our first round is at 12:30. So what we do is we bring our GetFast1.com motor hunt them out. We set it up. We have the boards up showing where everybody's position is. They come over to the motor home. We have a meeting, figure out who's racing who, how much they're going to bet. We hold the money until they race. Then once they all race, they come back to the next driver's meeting. We hand out the money to whoever won. The call outs happen again, and then basically we just do it all over again.
Now, I'm curious, you know, we're not, you know, us bracket racers, we're not generally betting except for, you know, little amounts of money. I think the most money I've won on a race was $1, betting. Right. You know, what's the most amount of money that you've seen bet on a specific race?
You want to do that, Jason?
He's talking about the most that we've had to put for us.
Yeah. So, yeah, one guy calls out another guy. All right, they're going to bet. What's the most money that you've seen two guys bet on a race?
So we have an Ultimate Street, the bets have to range from $50 to $300. So far, the most we have seen the max bet, I believe, one time of $300. It also came with the Road Trip Challenge, which was completed. So the total race ended up going to the winner was total pot with $400 that one race.
Okay.
Now over in Super Street, being that the cars are supposed to be the slower class, we lowered that. That one only ranges from $2,200.
Okay. So you
we're really trying to keep like the grassroots stuff going that people can fit it affordable to come out to.
I think that's a really good idea.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that's a really good idea to limit that like that. Because, yeah, you're going to get guys that are going to be like, some guys would try and intimidate other people. So I think by limiting it like you are, I think that's a really good idea.
Intimidation would be a $2,000
bet. That was our intention with the max bet rule was, to not, somebody wants to call somebody out and go, well, I'll race for $5,000. If you want to race for $5,000, I won't race you. We wanted to make sure that wasn't going to be an issue. And what me and Jason's jobs are when we're running the race is if one guy goes, well, I want to run for $300, the other guy goes, well, I want to run for $50, then me and Jason step in and go, okay, well, let's race for $150. Let's catch it in the middle.
Right.
And we negotiate it so the race happens. And in the end, if they don't agree to it, we set them out. Okay, y'all are racing for $150. Either you race or you lose a spot.
Right.
And that happens. So we get the races off. There's none of that, well, I'm going to outmoney you and that doesn't happen at the list. You see racing round after round after round with people. And most people don't want to bet a bunch of money. Just make no mistake, this is for bragging rights.
It's bragging rights. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got the fastest street car. That's what we're trying to prove. Who's got the fastest street car around? And it's not really about the money to us. It's about being fast and being the man. You gotta beat the man to be the man, and that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
How frequently?
Honestly, we've seen that over and over. Even our shootouts. So we don't charge anything for you to enter the shootout. You pay your normal test and tune fee to come in the track, and it's free to enter the shootout.
Wow, that's cool.
Over in Ultimate Street, they do like a $20 buy-in if they want to. Whoever makes it the furthest in the shootout takes that pot. But these guys come out and they'll run the shootouts. Every event we have, they'll come out and run the shootouts and. Generally, it's for no money. They're just spending their own money to get on the track. Because honestly, what we've seen is everybody just wants to come out and race. A lot of entry fees for a lot of races have kind of gotten pretty ridiculous and out of hand, if you ask me.
Sure.
How frequently, then, does the number one spot turn over?
The number one spot turn over, we had Brandon was at the top. Richard was at the top, then Brandon, so that's two. Then the beginning of the year, it was you, and then Pete Decker at one point, right?
Yeah, Pete Decker took it the first day out for me, so that was two there. Tuck, Tillman, I'm trying to remember if anybody beat Pete or who he lost the number one spot to. That wasn't Tuck. That was Tuck. So we had four number ones last year.
Wow. So it moves around.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Yeah, I like that part, too.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
And we've seen a lot of guys on the list make a lot of improvements this winter. So we expect the number one spot to be challenged fairly often this year.
Nice.
Over and over again. Everybody wants that spot, and they put the work in, they put the money in, they put the time in. It's going to be pretty exciting this year for sure.
Well, that's one of the big things too. Going back, we were talking about weights earlier. We've really stepped safety equipment up across both lists, so. That's constantly adding weight to guys, so they're having to go back and make improvements, trying to find every loophole they can in the rules to find places to cut bait because they're adding so much safety equipment. So the cars, if anything, they're almost saving, but they're almost maintaining their weight. If they are cutting weight, it's not like it's any huge drastic amount.
Right.
Yeah, and I can speak from experience and just knowing the guys on the list and without saying time stuff. Most of the guys on Ultimate Street have picked up in the eighth of a mile a second to a second and a half from what they were at the beginning of last year.
Wow.
So when you're talking about eighth mile racing, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And these guys from the beginning of last year to the end of last year picked up that much. And this winter, they've done even more work. So we're expecting some pretty big things.
That's awesome. I mean, the season sounds like it's in great form moving forward. You got your opening race here this weekend. I think it's great that you guys aren't charging an entry fee to get into the shootout, and that gives them a chance to get into the list with the heads-up bets. People are still able to make money up and down that top 10 as well. Now, another facet of the RVA, you can find more information. If you just Google RVA list, it's right on there. It pops right up. You got a very active social media and YouTube account, so you can find pit interviews and learn who the personalities are that are on the list at present. On top of that, Go Fast Racing or Go Fast One and then Performance Dynamics are both major parts of the list and that whole program. And that's your operation, Brandon. Tell me a little bit more about that and how that all came together.
Right. So I started Performance Dynamics 15 years ago. I wanted to give the local guys a place to go and get parts. At the time, I was mail-ordering my parts in, and, you know, it get delayed in the mail or you get sent the wrong thing. it was just kind of frustrating. So I started my own speed shop to try to have a local place for guys to come get parts and hang out and talk, kind of like the barber shop, you know.
Right.
You never know who you're going to run into in here, but you know, we sell nitrous, we fill nitrous bottles, we sell racing fuel, we change tires, we rebuild carburetors, we got a full retail speed shop. And then GetFast1.com is our mail order site, so we do mail order. We've got guys who work here all day, and all they do is pick and pull and ship orders and take phone orders. So we sponsored the RVA list through GetFast1.com because with YouTube and social media, we figured that would get a pretty good reach, and that's the easiest way to find us is through our GetFast1.com website. And GetFast1.com, we take care of all the videos for the list. We take care of all the interviews. We come to the track with the RV. You know, we're there to support the racer. I mean, we're there. If between rounds somebody breaks, I mean, it's nothing for me to tell one of my guys, hey, run up to the shop and grab a starter, grab a nitrous solenoid, you know. We're coming to the track, getting ready to leave to go to the race, and people are calling me, hey, bring fuel with you. I need 116, I need 110, you know, spark plugs. So we don't just sponsor, we really are involved in it. We want to see these guys do good. We want our local racing community to be known and have a name, and we want these guys to get some recognition for the hard work they put into these cars and the time they spend. So it's not just a sponsorship opportunity for us, it's really to try to grow the racing community here. And thus far, it's been working. I mean, we've got more and more races that are just popping up left and right for street cars, no prep stuff. We got Dot 93s doing Miles of Mayhem, and we're partnered with them. So basically, they're going to meet at Richmond Dragway, make passes, and they're going to drive to Colonial Beach, which is roughly, 60 miles away or 100 miles away? And then they're going to...
Yeah, there you go. Since about 60 miles away, checkpoints, it's going to be a 100-mile drive, their trailers.
Right. So we've had a ton of this stuff pop up. You know, and the more cars you have in a community that are set up around this street-style car, street racing car, that are street legal, the more events like this you can do and the more pool of cars you have to choose from. So we've really tried to just revitalize the racing community and the street car community around our area. And it seems to be working. I mean, the customers are there. They're behind us. The community's behind us. Johnny Davis at the racetrack, he's behind us. Jason, he stepped up huge to help me with this list. I mean, without him, there would be no way I could keep up with all the Facebook questions and feeds. And, you know, so it's really been a community effort here. GetFast1.com is a big sponsor for it, but that's just a little bit of what's happening. You know, behind the scenes, there's so many people. Jennifer Martin, she volunteers her time. She does all the live feeds when we're at the track. Matt Payne, he helps with Super Street. Then I got Donald Matthews. He helps me with the Ultimate Street. Like, when I'm racing, he's sitting there writing down who's winning, so when I get back, we know who's who. I mean, so we have tons of people that have supported this program and gotten behind it, and that's why it's been so successful.
Yeah, everybody's volunteering. I mean, even the racers. If somebody's car goes down or they can't make a race, they'll just come out to be there and volunteer their time any way they can to help get the show off.
Yeah, Steve Perdome, he's helped us when his car was down. He came out, he helped us organize and get people in the lanes and line them up. I mean, it's really been a community thing, and it's been awesome to see. I mean, everybody here is, of course, when you race somebody, you know, you want to beat them. There's no doubt about it. But in the pits, man, we're all buddies. You know, we're helping each other out in our cars. I mean, we do. If I didn't have a race one round, somebody needed a starter, I'd pull it off my truck and give it to them so they can make the next round. I mean, that's what we've got going on here. It's pretty awesome.
Well, I don't think there's a lot of racers out there that wouldn't try to do that on a level like this, you know, running on the local level and trying to inject some life back into the racing community. Certainly, we applaud that effort, and it's good to hear that it's going well. We wish you the best this weekend with the race coming up, and we absolutely look forward to hearing from you through the course of the summer, especially with the number of events that you guys have. When some people start moving up and down the top 10 lists for the RVA, hopefully you guys will be willing to keep in touch with us on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And any of the racers on the list, I'd be more than happy to sit down and talk with you all and
All right. Do
interviews.
Cool.
We encourage that. I mean, it's something pretty cool.
I'm all for it. I think that's awesome. You guys are doing a good thing. Usually this is the point where we ask you who helps keep the series going, but you ran through the list of volunteers. That's an extensive list, and it sounds like you got some good people that are dedicated to the cause for the right reasons.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, I appreciate you coming on the show and hanging out with us for a little while. Again, it's the RVA list. Brandon Terry, Jason Blankenship, overseeing the quarter and eighth mile portions of the RVA list. They run at Richmond Dragway. The first event is coming up this Saturday. Track goes live at, I think you said it was at 11 o'clock.
11 o'clock.
Track opens at 10, 11 o'clock, and the track goes live. First round is at 12:30. You got your chance to jump on the RVA list. Guys, I appreciate you making some time, especially on the short notice, and we look forward to keeping in touch through the summer, man.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us on.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, guys. Good luck.
We'll see you now. There goes Brandon Terry and Jason Blankenship with the RVA list. Cool couple guys. They're doing a good thing down there in Virginia, and, I mean, hard to argue with it, really, you know.
Yeah, no, it's very cool. I mean, I will say it's the type of series that if I could find a way to run one something like that, I definitely would be interested in doing it. It's pretty cool. But it sounds like they're trying to keep it, like I said, fairly low cost and having fun at the same time. So it's definitely pretty neat. I just can't believe it's racing season already.
Yeah. Kevin, let me put you in. The back half of what's turned into a doubleheader, episode number 36. We're halfway home. Kevin Orr joining us on the hotline. Kevin, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
We're doing all right, getting that Corvette ready for the TNT hot rod season. I'm sure it's all buttoned up and ready to go, and you could make a pass tomorrow if you had to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
Is the race tomorrow? I'd have to be out there till midnight tonight.
No, it's not tomorrow, thankfully. That's good.
Well, there you go. No, I feel like I could race after hurting myself, but whether I should race, I'm not sure that's the best plan.
I would say, what are you, I mean, overall, I mean, you and I chatted just a bit, obviously for the viewers at home that aren't aware, so you fell off a ladder, right?
Well, actually, I didn't fall off the ladder. The ladder fell out from under me.
Oh.
And I landed on my back, so they called it a burst compression fracture of one of my vertebrae. Oh.
Which sounds terrible.
Yeah, it wasn't one of my better days. I spent 8 days in the hospital.
Oh, my God.
But the good thing is I can walk and I can do all that stuff, and I'm doing physio now. But it's kind of hard to imagine going and laying under my car and maybe taking the transmission out or anything like that to go service it.
Well, that's why we have friends, Kevin.
Well, yes, you know something? Joe Bonifaro's two kids, Ryan and Patrick, came up here and winterized it for me after I hurt myself.
That's very nice of them.
Yes, because all I had managed to do was fog it. I fogged it, I put it in the garage, and hurt myself.
Yeah.
And those guys showed up and did all that stuff for me. And so, yeah, like I say, I feel like I could probably go race. I'm just not too sure that that's the best plan.
Well, it's probably not the best plan right at the moment, at least, right? I'm sure the doctor probably wouldn't sign off on that at the moment. But, you know, you just got the brace off, you said, a couple of weeks ago, right?
2 weeks ago Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I mean, obviously, there's no rush at this point. You know, whether it's 2018 or 2019, obviously, we'll you can get back out there. The races will still be there. I mean, your health and recuperation is first and foremost. And like
exactly.
I said, you just started physiotherapy, so I mean, I'm assuming it's not easy at this point.
It's no, but it's it could have been a whole lot worse.
Oh, sure.
You know, I didn't take an ambulance to the hospital because, you know, being kind of dumb when you fall down, people say, "Do you want an ambulance?" "No, no, no, just give me a few minutes. I'll be all right." And I got them actually to pick me up and drive me to the hospital. And when I got to the hospital, the people there are like, "You did what? You got here how? Can you feel this?" And they're banging my feet with their little hammers and stuff. And so I guess in hindsight, it could have been a whole pile worse.
Oh, that's, I mean, really is amazing. I mean, like you said, you spent 8 days in the hospital. You think about how many people, I mean, cripes, if you have open heart surgery, you don't spend 8 days in the hospital.
No, and you know, like you say, nowadays they try to kick you out as fast as they can.
Right.
They wouldn't even let me roll over in the hospital. I had to ring the bell. "Can you roll me over?" So, you know, it could have been way worse. I could have been, anyway, we don't even want to go there.
Yeah, well, we're glad to hear that, you know, you're on the mend and doing well.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, before the accident, what was, I mean, what were you thinking plan-wise for 2018? Kind of the same thing as 2017, really concentrating on TNT Hot Rod?
Well, 2017, I was still kind of chasing the IHRA, and then they bailed on us.
Right.
And I'm not blaming them. I get it. The car counts were down and everything, but
sure.
I'm kind of disappointed. But my plan after that was, okay, I'll do the TNT, and I'm going to go do some adjacent stuff because the car will go fast enough,
yeah.
And I have enough delay in the timer to go on a 400 treat.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of like one of those, hold my beer and watch this moments. I'd been up that ladder several times already. It was just that one time I was very near the top. My feet were probably 7 feet off the floor, and the feet of the ladder shot out from under me, and boom, I'm on my back.
Now, you're self-employed, right? So this is a work accident, right?
Well, it was.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm the only employee that generates income. My wife works for me. She does my office work.
Yep.
So I've been paying people to do my work because I don't want to lose my customers.
Sure.
So far I haven't lost any of them, but in the meantime, none of that's good for the pocketbook. However, having said that, Charlene Dennis Lepp, I guess you know her from the RCSS up here.
Yep, absolutely.
I hurt myself December 7th. She put something together, and by Christmas Eve, she had raised nearly $6,000 for us.
Wow.
Yeah, so the racers totally boggled my mind. People were donating money that I don't even know who they are.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It's a nice problem to have right there.
Yeah, yeah, that's really great. Yeah, I mean, I know that, when she started, she sent me a message, and, you know, I was definitely, you know, all in and helping my buddy out. But, that's incredible. That's really great news. Well, hopefully that, you know, helped out a little bit. Obviously, you know, it's a tough situation for, you know, anybody to be in, let alone someone who, you know, is a sole proprietor and, you know, relies upon themselves every day to be able to put food on the table. So,
it paid my mortgage, and it paid for my brace because our health plan up here, you know, universal coverage. Well, not quite. The guy showed up at the hospital with these calipers and a tape measure and a little tablet computer and measured me up and then said to me, "Well, how do you want to pay?" And I said, "Well, I guess with a credit card." And he goes, "Good, it's $2,500, and I wouldn't even start making it until you pay."
Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's awfully nice of them.
Exactly.
I mean, heck, in the construction industry, I mean, usually it's, on a bad day, it's 50% down and 50% at the, you know, completion of the project, right?
Well, you mean as far as payment? Well, yeah. Well, that's what I said to like Joe Bonifaro and guys. I'm like, I wish I could get paid like that.
Right. Yeah, 100% up front.
Yeah, job's done. How do you want to, hey, job's done. The guy didn't even do it. Okay, here's your quote. How do you want to pay?
Right.
So, yeah, that was, you know, surprise number one. And anyway, it's all good. Well, I'm happy, you know. What are you going to do? Could be worse.
Yeah, we're glad you're still upright, and I'm assuming that even though you may not be back behind the wheel, at least at the beginning of the season, that you're going to at least be planning to come out to the races and hang out with us, right?
Oh, absolutely. That is definitely the plan, because I have a whole lot of people that I need to go. First of all, some of them I need to meet.
Yeah.
And other ones that I need to thank. And we still want to support the series and keep it going. So we're going to do our best. Yeah, absolutely. You'll see Laurie and I there.
Well, that's good.
Just with no trailer on the back of the motorhome.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get a little better than 5 miles to the gallon.
to say that it could be worse when you're talking about an exploded, ruptured blow, all that, it sounds awful. So to hear you in such good spirits, and also at the same time making plans to get to the track and making plans to get back in the car this year, that's definitely good news, and sounds like you're taking it pretty well.
Well, you know, I'm a glass half full kind of person, so I think that's a better way to look at it. It could be way worse, and I'm good, and so we're going to be there, and we're going to, maybe I'll just be the bartender.
Well, it was funny, too, because when I messaged Kevin tonight, I'm like, hey, how are you feeling, you know? And he's like, oh, it's funny you messaged me tonight, because I was actually thinking about how your finger is. And I'm like, my finger? I'm like, who cares about my finger?
Well, you know something? You need to use that finger on the button, because it'll hurt to hold the button down, and you'll be anxious to let it go.
I don't know if I told this story on the air. But Phil Harnden, actually, his first question to me was, that's not your trans brake button, is it? Your finger, your trans brake finger, is it? I'm like, no, it's not my trans brake finger.
Well, it's going to have to be now.
That's right.
Yeah. Put some more time in your timer there, and you'll be good.
So Chris isn't familiar, and obviously a lot of the viewers at home aren't familiar with your car. I mean, your car is a really unique piece. Can you tell the viewers, give the viewers, I guess, a little bit of background on your car?
Oh, I bought my car in 1982. It was originally a 427, 435 horse, 67 Corvette with transistorized ignition and all of that stuff that Barrett Jackson would have you think is now worth, I don't know how many gazillion dollars. I bought the thing for 10 grand. I drove it home. It didn't have the right motor in it, because those motors, you didn't buy that kind of a car and not pound it and blow the motors up.
Right.
I'm pretty sure those guys have sold more numbers matching 435 horse cars than GM even made.
Yep. there's no doubt that twice as many of them have been sold that ever existed, for sure.
It's ridiculous. When I bought the car, it had blue and white shag carpet. It had blue velvet headliner and blue velvet door panels. It was customized in the 70s.
Yep.
It sounds awful.
It was just an old Corvette. I paid 10 grand. I mean, you know, in 1990, we back half the car because I had it going low 11s, and all of a sudden it's like, well, I want to go 1090. But to go 1090, you have to have a solid diff in the back. Well, I guess we better do a back half. And then in 2000, I drove into the guardrail at Cayuga, so it took 5 years to do the front half of the chassis, and, well, here we are. I'd probably drive it more now than I drove it when it was a street car.
Now, was that car originally a removable hardtop?
Well, yeah, it was a roadster. I never had the soft top. The hardtop, actually, I did not cut the frame in that car when we back-halved it.
Okay.
I sold the frame out of that car to somebody who wanted a 67 frame for a resto job.
Yep.
That's how I bought my first closed trailer.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the hardtop, same thing. A guy, I got a 67 Roadster with a convertible, but I really want a hardtop. Well, the hardtop hung in my garage for 20 years. So I'm like, well, I'm not doing anything with it. You might as well buy it off me. So, yeah, the, you know, it's, even when it was on the street, it had 411 gears. It had side pipes.
Yeah.
It was really cool. You could go onto the highway and just nail it, scream by everybody, but you can't drive 6,000 RPM forever. So then you slow down and they all pass you again.
Right.
And the novelty wears off and you go, yeah, and then I went to the drag strip and the car went like 1280s. I'm like, well, you know, we do this and then we do this, and all of a sudden it was going 1180s, then 1120s, and then, yeah, and it the hook was set.
Now, when you bought that car, were you looking specifically for a Corvette, or were you thinking, I just want something to toy around with?
Believe it or not, when I bought that car, the guy that I bought it from had owned and sold that car three times. He never had it from new.
Oh.
But he kept buying it and selling it. And he was the one who said to me, Kevin, guys didn't buy 435-horse cars to putt around town. We bought them, we pounded them, we blew them up. We went to the dealer to try to get warranty.
They laughed.
He wanted me to buy his Pantera.
Okay.
Which he also had, and other than that, I know Tim Horton died in a Pantera one time.
Yeah.
I really don't exactly know what the Panteras were, except for I think they had big block Fords in them.
That's right, yeah.
And he used to say, well, yeah, it has overheating problems. Well, so did mine. I tried to cruise mine down Yonge Street in Toronto when I had it on the road, and you'd have to bail because 200 degrees didn't look very good on the temperature gauge.
Yeah.
So it was, my wife drove it to work way more than I ever drove it.
And that was, that was when you decided it's time for me to take this off the road and make it a race car.
Well, first time I went to the track with it, it went a solid 1545 and with a 396, and it was a fresh motor. The thing wouldn't get out of its own way. Couldn't even get it out of third gear.
Yep.
Before the finish line. So then I met a guy through work who said to me, well, take your motor to John Stefko. And he does lots of stock and super stock and roundy round stuff. And the same motor, same cam, same everything, car went 1280.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that was pretty cool, but it still had the Corvette rear end.
Yep.
And then we got it down to 1180s, and we used to go to the track for a fun weekend with two spare half shafts in the truck, and was okay. Then I bought a wide ratio Muncie for it, used, of course, but put that in the car, and all of a sudden we would go through those two half shafts in one day, and then we would be taking U-joints out of a broken one and putting them in another, trying to make, anyway. It soon became evident the Corvette rear end wasn't really the way to go.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's like, well, I'm going 1120s now. Maybe we should just do what we need to do. And then we went super, back in those days, super street racing, because it was NHRA.
Yep.
And still with the four speed. I had the four-speed in the car in 2000 when I crashed, and then we did the front half, and I'm like, oh, the car weighs 400 pounds less. I really want to see how it works with four-speed. Well, when the car was 3,000 pounds, the more you shifted gears, the straighter the car would go down the track.
Yeah.
When it was light, the more I shifted gears, the more out of control I would get. Yeah. So when Lori and I towed the car all the way to Indy in the fall for their national open one year, which typically is not the greatest prep deal in the first place.
Right.
Well, when I shifted into second gear and ended up in Buddy's lane in front of him, it's like, yeah, I don't think this is going to work. So we towed it home. We took another 2 years off while we put a glide in it and joined the dark side. And we put the timers and the throttle stops and the glide, and now all I do is, like you, I let go of the button at the appropriate, hopefully the appropriate time, and drive down the track.
It's sad, isn't it?
Well, my biggest worry was it would be boring.
Right.
But John Vineyard, I guess you remember his name from the old days.
Yeah.
Vineyard said to me, yeah, Kevin, you might think it's going to be boring, but winning rounds isn't boring either.
That's, you know, it's 100% right. You know, my dad took the 5-speed out of my Corvette, you know, he was really sad to have done so at the time. And I will say, you know, his first few passes in the car, you know, it was definitely boring for him. But I think he may have even said that to me as well, that, you know, what's not boring? What's not boring is being competitive. What's not boring is being able to spend some time at home during the week with my wife and kids and not being at the garage every single night doing maintenance.
Not laying under the car getting black and clutch dust because you have to re-shim the clutch every 10 passes.
That's right. Yep, that's right.
Yeah, I did all that, and it just became, well, first of all, I couldn't, you know, when I couldn't drive the car down the track anymore when it was light, a lot of people said to me, oh, you just need to figure out the clutch. And I'm like, you know what? I've been doing this for 20 years with this car. I think I've looked at the clutch enough.
Yeah.
So now I try as much as possible to do my work on the car at home. If it's hot outside, I turn the air conditioner on in the garage. And I do what I need to do, and I put it in the trailer. And a good day racing is take it out of the trailer, warm it up, race. Hopefully it's late in the day before you put it back in the trailer.
Right.
And take it out again the next morning. Don't even take the hood off.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah, there is absolutely no doubt there's a lot to be said for running a Power Glide compared to a 4-speed or a 5-speed.
Yeah.
Just... Yeah, I'm sure it's not as fun from a ride standpoint, and pulling all those gears has got to be a blast, but...
Well, you know something, when you know, my car, the converter in the car, that was the other thing. Everybody said, oh, once you put the automatic in, you'll have to stop working on the car. Well, the first year I had the Power Glide, I had to go through 5 different converters before we found one that worked. I didn't buy 5, but
right.
Here, try this one, and finally you find one that you think works, and then phoned Hughes and said, well, this one works, can you make me one like this? You know, putting your foot on the floor and the converter going to 5,700 RPM and then letting go of the button, it's still pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's still a fun ride for sure.
Yeah.
I know it.
And like you say, you know, waiting for your photos in the winner's circle—that's pretty good too.
That's always really nice. Yeah, like I said, taking the winner's circle photos and loading your car back up at the same time, knowing that it's still in one piece.
Driving it into the trailer,
as opposed
to pulling it in. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yep. There's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, I think so. You know, since and I live. Every track, the closest track to us is more than 2 hours away. Typically, for me to go from my house to Lancaster is 4 hours. Nobody, until this winter when I hurt myself, there's nobody around here where I live to help me work on the car.
Yeah, I didn't realize you were that far away, Kevin.
That's a haul.
Well, you know, I used to listen to the guys in the TNT complain about having to tow all the way to Grand Bend. And I'd be looking at them like, what does it take you, like 3 hours? You know, that's my problem with trying to join up the NHRA, except for the open thing that they have at Cayuga.
Right.
Everything is 8 hours.
Wow. Yeah.
8 hours and a border crossing.
And that's assuming the border crossing's smooth. If it takes a long time, well, then it's longer.
Right.
You're talking about driving the car to the trailer. Jason has a seatbelt on the passenger side of his car to hold the trophy so that he can drive it into the trailer and not have to worry about it bouncing around.
Yeah.
Perfect.
I thought it was cool. He showed me that one time. I said, is this for passengers? He goes, no, it's for trophies.
And then we had to take it out so we could put the CO2 bottle somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
For all this, the goofiness, the shifters and the throttle stop and all that stuff.
I would say one of these days I'm going to get rid of all that stuff. I'm not sure when, but
You know something? I'd love to go race the some of those deals. The fastest guy there wins, but
right.
I don't have the time and I don't have the money. So being an index racer, well, that works for me.
Yeah, I would say there's a reason why I race super gas, and it's the same reason you do.
Exactly, and you know, since all I've done is pro tree racing for more than 20 years, quite frankly, I really suck at bracket racing.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I have to say, I really do, that's one thing that I really do like. I really do like the pro tree, and, you know, I'm not bad bracket racing as long as I have my delay box, but if you make my take my delay box out of the car, yeah, I'm terrible. So, and not to say that I couldn't get better at it, but you know, it would certainly take a while, and
it's another whole learning curve.
Oh yeah, and you think about it, I mean, now you're thrown to the wolves with guys who have been out there doing it for 20 years. So
yeah, or more. And that's the thing with like the TNT series. You're jumping into a pool full of sharks.
Oh yeah.
Yep. When you go to Lancaster and the top nine qualifiers are between 7 with 4 zeros and 7 with 3 zeros and a 9.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. If you can go some rounds there, in my opinion, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I think I've told this story on the air once before. One of the TNT races I raced at Lancaster, I was 7-0-0-1, and I was certain that I had the buy run first round, and I pulled up, and they were not pulling me aside for the buy run. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I went 7-0-0-1, and sure enough, Ted rolls up, and they give him the buy. I'm like, Ted, how do you have the buy? I went 7-0-0-1. He's like, oh, I went 7-0-0. I'm like, give me a break, for God's sake.
I generally don't qualify good in the TNT series because I'm usually too fast.
Yeah.
But I do remember once winning the number one qualifier at Lancaster.
Yep.
Which to me is like a really proud thing, because at Lancaster, seriously, against guys like Jeff Sobczynski and those guys who go there all the time and kill us on the anyway, yeah, it's a good deal.
Oh yeah, yep, absolutely, yeah, something to be proud of for sure.
Yeah.
So when are we going to see you? When are we going to see you out? Are you going to be out the very first race, you think?
Our plan is to definitely go to the Memorial Day weekend thing, okay, that Steve McCarrick always sponsored.
Right.
So I gather that since he sold his business, I'm not exactly sure what his deal is this year, but he's still doing something, I understand.
Well, I say, so, I don't think he, I don't, even though he retired, I don't think he sold the race car, right?
No, I don't think so. No, I never heard anything like that, especially since he was in second place last year,
right,
and the last race got rained out. I mean, he had a very good possibility of being able to go by Tom Coonley, but can't race if it's raining.
Right. We got to get, Chris, we got to get Steve on the show. Steve actually doesn't live too far from our studio here out in Seneca Falls.
We talked about this last time you were in town, I think.
That's possible. Yeah, and he's got, you look at, I can't imagine how angry it makes some of the guys to lose to Steve. He's a super nice guy, an older guy. He just retired and sold his business. Is it a 55 or is it a 56 Chevy?
I think it's a 55, but I'm not sure.
You're a tri-five guy.
Yeah, I know. I should know for sure.
And it hangs the front wheels 3 feet in the air on every pass.
Right. But, you know, it's an original car. It's not a chassis car, all the rest of it. And you watch this guy go out, and I'm sure the guys that have all the chassis work done, tube cars, all the rest of it, they go and they look at Steve's car. I mean, it's not a show car. It's a race car. And when they lose to Steve, I'm sure they are so angry. That dude is tough. He is really, really tough.
You know what? I never – the only time I get angry if I lose is when I blow it.
Yeah,
I think
me too.
I blew it. I never get that excited. If I win, it's great. If I lose, it's a good day racing.
We've had some extensive conversations in different walks of motorsport about a line that Kevin just said. It's like, I don't mind losing as long as I'm not the person that made me lose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, I'm not going – I may have to even run on the conservative side of things to make sure that I'm not the reason why I get beat. And if that results in me getting beat, I still cause myself to lose.
That's right.
But if I nail that run and I get beat,
so be it.
You got beat by a quadruple zero.
Right.
There was nothing you were doing to that car to make any faster. That was as good as it was going to get.
Right.
No. Yes, I have time slips where the margin of victory is less than a thou. And you go to Lancaster or to Empire, I guess it's with the four decimal places, and it's 000 something. Yeah, well, that's a pretty good race one way or the other.
Unfortunately, it is very easy to play the what-if game afterwards, right? And so I will say probably...
Bench racing. There's entire postseason parties built around this topic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 4 out of 5 times, I would say, though, I look back at a race afterwards and I'm angry at myself to a certain extent because it's like, oh, if you would have done this different, if you could have changed this, if you would have taken time out, if you would have put time in, you know.
That's because you're an engineer perfectionist who beats yourself up about not putting in the amount of time that you're supposed to.
Everyone wants to win, right? And the only way you get better and the only way you learn is to be critical of yourself and say, all right, what can I do to improve?
All your friends are going to be nice to you when they criticize your past. You're the only one that's going to be honest about it. And Phil Hunter. And Phil will be honest about it.
And, you know, when you think about it, oh, I broke out by a thou. A thousandth of a second.
Right.
How much is that?
Right.
You know, like it's so minute.
Yeah.
But when you look at the math and a number, it's a big number. Well, yeah, but it's inches.
Oh, yeah, yep.
So, no, I just enjoy it. It doesn't matter. If I win, it's great. If I lose, it's still great. Everybody's fun to be around. And then you get to watch the other guys drilling each other with their 10,000th package.
Well, I would say now you can go around and tell people at the track when they're angry, right? It's like, hey, look. This is better than falling off a ladder and wearing a back brace for 3 months, right?
Exactly. I'll bring my brace with me, and I'll just put it in the trailer.
Is that brace go from the back of your neck all the way down to the base of your spine?
Yeah, it went halfway down my butt.
Oh.
And originally, when I first got it, it went from like above my boobs to right below my pelvis. So the whole idea is that you can't bend forward and you can't twist. You can't move that part of your back. And the deal was you can't wear it to bed, but you can't get out of bed and you can't even sit up in bed without putting it on.
Yeah, I was going to say, for a while, I remember when you were discharged from the hospital. I mean, you were still bedridden, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
he says.
I'm also not one to, first of all, I have no benefit plan. So, you know, I guess maybe if I had a job where somebody was paying me to lay in bed, then
sure.
I could have.
Yeah.
But, so everything's different when you're self-employed and you got to do what you got to do. So, you know, I would, like I say, I would get a guy to drive me around and I'd point, Tim, do this. Tim, do that.
Right,
Tim,
right.
Can you put that ladder up? Because I can't.
And I'm sure, I mean, boredom had to play into it too, right? I mean, everybody...
Oh, it's terrible. That's probably the worst part. It's not like you can say, oh, you know what? I got nothing better to do. I'll just go to the garage and do some work on the car. Well, no, you won't.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, was there ever a point in that exchange where you were in the full brace where you did... move or twist or anything and it caught you by surprise, reminded you weren't supposed to do that?
No, because the way it was made, you can't, like other than falling down, and which was the other issue was when I hurt myself and I got out of the hospital, we had gone through a little warm spell, which I think you guys did too,
right?
And everything melted here. And then it froze again, and so I would go out the front door, and everything would be ice, and I'd be like, oh,
I'm going back in.
Wow.
Can't fall down. Wow. So, you know, that was a drag, but when was the car show in Toronto, I guess, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, two weekends ago. ago.
Yeah.
So I went there by myself. That was like right after, more or less, I got my brace off. And I walked that whole car show, which was 300,000 square feet. And, of course, it's, you know, a whole bunch of aisles.
Yep.
And I came home and said to Lori, I think I did too much today.
Yeah.
But, you know, no pain, no gain, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I'm sure they did a lot for your recovery, too, though. I mean, after being idle that long, getting out there and walking a little bit could probably, your muscles probably appreciated it.
Even, like, from day one and even in the hospital, the day the guy brought me that brace, I would buzz my little buzzer, and I need you to get me up. I want to walk. Because I knew if I wasn't walking around, they weren't going to let me out.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, and then same thing. Like, they talked to me like as though I just laid around for 7 weeks or 8 weeks or 10 weeks. Well, yes and no. I'd get the brace on in the morning and be up, try to walk and try to do things to keep moving because I didn't want to totally seize up.
Yeah, yeah, well. Good for you for having the wherewithal to see that firsthand, right? And realize, I mean, again, it's minor, but it's like I wore that brace on my finger for 5 days, 6 days, and when he took it off, it's like, all right, I'm like, can I bend it? He's like, oh, yeah, you can bend it. It's fine. It's just broken at the tip, and it's like I'm trying to bend my finger, and it's like, oh, my God, I can barely bend it. It's like it kills to bend, right?
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, yeah, you take it to an extreme and say, okay, now we're going to put you in a back brace for 6 weeks. Okay, yeah, hop out of bed, Kevin. See how you do.
Actually, it was nearly 12.
Are you in some sort of physical therapy regimen now to try and build some of that muscle strength?
Just started a week ago on Monday with a physiotherapist. So the exercises, some of them cause some discomfort in my back. Some of them I do, and I'm like, well, what is this supposed to do?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm 56 years old, and every time we ever worked out, it was if you didn't feel it, you weren't really doing anything.
Right.
So, I don't know. But anyway, I went again this week, and here's a couple of more exercises to add in the regimen. So, we'll see. He told me it'll be 6 months before I'm 90% again.
Wow.
Yeah. And I said to him, and let me guess, I'll never be 100%, right? And he's, nope. Well, there you go.
Well, there you go, yeah.
I guess he was honest, at least.
Yeah, he can't help that.
Yeah.
So six months from now, so let's see, it's April, so...
Yeah, that's like September.
6 months from now? Or 6 months from the injury?
Dragway 42, 1090 and 990 race, I think they got.
Yeah.
No, hang on. 6 months from the injury or 6 months from right now?
6 months from
last week.
From last week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm thinking that fall time frame, we'll be looking at Kevin maybe thinking about getting in the car.
Well, yeah, fall. I'd like to think so.
He's thinking about it now.
Yeah, well.
I just think that's probably, if everything was great and, you know, you never lost control and nothing ever happened, it'd all be fine and dandy.
Right.
But for the sake of one summer, I mean, when I crashed the car, it took 5 years for me to get the money and get the thing back together. And then when we decided that the standard transmission wasn't the way to go anymore, well, that was another 2 years. So that was just because of money and finances and time. So I'm pretty sure for my health, I could, if I don't get to race this summer, well, it's not going to kill me. And I might not like it.
That's
I'm not a very good spectator, but when we go through the border and we hit the duty free, I guess I could stock up on enough beer to be a spectator.
I agree. I think that's a great idea.
And I think I could be wrong, but my guess is Mark Herbel will probably let you help out if you can't just be a spectator.
Well, Mark and Dave have their own little routine going.
Yeah.
So unless something breaks and he needs help like everybody does in our deal, you know, we all help each other. I remember watching Roy Lister a few years ago when he was going rounds, and I would go and I don't even know what to put gas in his cars, and Lori took me aside, Kevin, don't do that. Just watch what he does. He has a routine.
Yeah.
He pours the gas in, he puts the cap on, he wipes it twice this way and once that way with a rag, and like, no, racers are superstitious.
Right, right.
So just like me, my left glove goes on first, my right glove goes on second, and so yeah, we're gonna go and spectate, and see. And I mean, I've asked one or two people if they wanted to drive my car for the summer.
Yeah.
Problem with my car is A, it's kind of violent, and B, it, only little people fit.
Right.
You know, like, I think you're probably too tall, and Ted Barnes would probably fit, but he's got a car.
Right, right.
Tyler Helene would definitely fit, but he's got a 500-inch Maverick.
Yeah.
So who would you, you know, who would you let do it?
Well, yeah, like I said, you got to find someone that would fit, somebody that would want to drive it because they don't have their own ride, and then on top of that, it's somebody that you would trust in the car, right?
Exactly. You know, I've driven the car. I've driven the car often enough to know, you know, it's 9:30 at night and you're at Empire and comes off the stop and it starts to move sideways. It's probably not worth trying to win that round.
Right, right. Yep.
But, you know, that all comes with experience.
Is Kevin
better
to feel
to drive it into the trailer and try again tomorrow than to pretend I'm John Forrest.
As Kevin gets to feeling better, he's going to be able to poke around in the car a little bit.
Yep.
Yep.
And theoretically, think about what the spot that he's going to be coming into this year. If he does get to race in the fall, everybody else has run their stuff all summer. It's all beat up. It's all wore out.
Oh,
it's all,
yeah.
And his stuff's all going to be fresh and had all summer to take it on it.
They'll be breaking stuff and all should be fresh.
That's right.
Glass half full, right?
Yeah, glass half full. I told you that. You bet.
Well, Kevin, hey, it was really great catching up with you. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Glad you're feeling a little bit better, and you know, definitely looking forward to, you know, having you come out to the races and hang out with us this summer, if nothing else.
Looking forward to seeing you too.
Is anybody, before we let you go, anybody that you want to give a shout out to or thank or anything before we let you go?
Just my wife, Lori, for putting up with me hurting myself on a reasonably regular basis, or an unreasonably regular basis, however you want to look at that.
Yes, and thank you, Lori, for letting Kevin come hang out with us at the races, too, occasionally. We appreciate it.
Yeah, well, she'll be the one driving the motor home like usual.
Right. All right, well, thanks, Kevin. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Jason.
Hey, we'll talk to you soon.
Get well soon.
See ya. See you, Chris.
Take care. Bye now.
Thanks.
There goes Kevin Orr in good spirits.
Yes, he's a super good guy. Obviously, you know, you can tell from his personality, definitely a glass half full guy.
He seems like a fun guy. I was intrigued by his, if I can't race, I'll be bartender. What race?
He's Canadian.
If anybody didn't pick that up in the conversation, he's from Canada. We talked about the border crossing, and he sounded Canadian the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It didn't knock the
accent. I have to say, I didn't realize he was from that far away. I mean, I just assumed that
4 hours is a haul.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, and that's the Lancaster. So I mean, now you got to add another, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes on top of that to get to Empire. So I mean, yeah, you got a 5-hour drive to come to a race at Empire
plus border crossing.
Plus
which
border
could go
crossing. Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah. That's.
We've had some Derby guys that tried to get across the border, and it is not a fun time. It is. What are you coming across the border with a salvage car for?
Right.
Oh, here we go.
Right.
You know, at least this thing's more visibly appealing. It doesn't get everybody's attention quite the same. But yeah, the racers with modifieds and stuff trying to go back and forth. I've heard some horror stories about it, and I can't imagine. That's one thing that you know, those Canadians that come down to race in the States, they're dedicated to it because I don't know a lot of people that would put up with that, but they're definitely dedicated to it, to travel that far and put up with that much nonsense, even if it's just a periodic basis.
And I have to say, you know, I won't say I've never heard an issue or never had a problem going
stop.
Into Canada.
Stop right there. Don't say another thing because you're going to curse somebody.
Yeah, myself, probably.
Yourself or someone you care about.
Right.
Don't do it. You can think about it, but don't do it.
But it's always coming home. Always coming home. That's when it's the most difficult.
I live here, and you don't want me to come back.
Right. I'm just trying to get home. That's all.
Never mind the $10,000 stuffed on the undercarriage of the
truck. Right. With the trailer full of cocaine. And Yeah, it's amazing though. I mean, at times it's like you just breeze right through and there's absolutely nothing, and then times when you're like, guys, we've done this before.
And you can't joke about the race fuel, actually.
No, you can't.
You can't joke about it. You can't say, yeah, it's supposed to be race fuel, but it's actually a 55-gallon drum full of moonshine.
Right.
They frown on that.
Yes. Yes. They do not take well to
no.
jokes. No.
There's no humor at the border.
No.
We could share some stories there. One time we tried to get to Granby for a dirt track race. We tried hard.
Didn't make it.
We got to Granby. We tried hard to get to Granby for a race.
Yep.
We tried very hard to get to Granby for a race. We ultimately did get to Granby.
Oh, you made it.
Yep, we
made it. Made it to Granby at least.
At least. Yeah. We had to go meet up with everybody then go to the next
right, town. Right.
It was a great time. What do you think? This is a nice doubleheader. I mean, going into, you know, at, let's say, arguing point of, what time did we talk? 6:15? At 6:15, to not have a show.
Right.
Ended up not too bad.
Yeah, we did okay.
What do you think? We good for the night?
I think so.
Think so? I think so. We appreciate the guys from
RVA.
The RVA strip coming out and hanging out with us for a little while, and Kevin Orr making some time to talk with us. I'm interested to keep up with how the list goes for RVA and seeing how that thing moves up and down. I was excited to be able to share a picture of that Fairmont. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Initially, the picture was great, but I couldn't find one in the gallery.
Oh.
So we finally stumbled across it. There's no shortage of clicking there, but...
Yeah, maybe we can give the audience updates as the list changes from race to race. We can show some of that stuff.
Those guys are pretty good dudes. I'm sure that we could get updates on that on the regular. April the 5th, we're going to have Kathy Fisher on. She's a top dragster and TV personality. April the 19th, Ron Dean is going to be on. He was a grand champion in Empire. And we're working on a May 3rd date as well. We're also in talks with moms to get them on before the start of the year because the start of the year is coming fast. They've got all sorts of changes and stuff for this year. Their schedule's done, so they've got a bunch of big stuff. Some talking points now that have been built in, so I'm looking forward to getting them on. So a lot of good stuff coming for the Final Round Drag Racing Podcast when we're back here at the North Park Building at Academy Square. But this time around, it's going to do it for us on this tour of the Final Round. We'll see everybody again in 2 weeks when we have Kathy Fisher on the air. We'll see everybody then.
This has been the Final Round Drag Racing Podcast, coming to you live from the FingerLakes1.com studios in downtown Seneca Falls, New York. We'll see you right back here again in 2 weeks. Thanks for watching.